Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of American Criminal. In our latest season, the child of Italian immigrants sets out to achieve the American dream. And if he has to spill some blood along the way, so be it. Listen to American Criminal, Al Capone, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get ad-free access to the entire season first, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
Before we get into this episode, there's a trigger warning. We wanted to give you a heads up that we will be discussing sexual assault content that happened between two of the OC characters in the previous episode. We want to be sensitive to the subject matter, so if you want to skip forward in time, please check our show notes for when to skip to. Help is always available for anyone struggling with the trauma of sexual assault. RAIN is the nation's largest anti-sexual violence organization and offers help to survivors. If you need to speak to someone, you can call their hotline at 1-800-656-HOPE.
Welcome to the OC Bitches.
Welcome to the OC Bitches. Today we are season 2, episode 24, the dearly beloved the finale of season 2. Can you believe we're here?
No.
So we're super excited. Our guest today is an incredibly talented actor, writer, and director, and probably more than that, Logan Marshall Green. Logan grew up in the theater and is an MFA graduate of NYU Tisch School of the Arts. When he's not doing theater, he's acting in films such as Ridley Scott's Prometheus, Spider-Man Homecoming, and the upcoming Netflix film Lou, produced by J.J. Abrams with Allison Janney. And Say that for me correctly.
Journey?
Journey Smollett.
I wanted to make sure I said that correctly. Sorry. TV shows such as Dark Blue Quarry, and currently he can be seen in Big Sky. He also wrote and directed his first feature, Adopt a Highway, starring Ethan Hawke, released in 2019. You all know him as Trey, Ryan's bad news brother on the OC. Please welcome Logan. Did I get all that right?
You're a busy man.
I've been busy, I suppose. Not anymore, though. Here I am. No, thanks for having me. This is amazing. It's a trip, actually.
I know. Does this look familiar at all?
Yeah, it's kind of my point of view from that pool house.
Yeah.
Staring out into the abyss.
Right. Yeah. It's so funny because when we first talked about, you know, hoping and wanting you to come on, I was like, he's too busy. There's no way we're going to get Logan in here. Like, there's no way he's going to be able to do it. He's too busy and come and talk to us. And you know what? Here you are. So I'm shocked and very flattered and honored that you're willing to be here with us. So.
I'm excited to be here. And I mean, I'm not busy as much as I am just covered in kids and a dad. And, you know, I just dropped them off and came out here.
But yeah. That's the busiest, though. A parent, there's nothing busier.
It's true.
I don't care what people say. It's literally the hardest job and the most busy you will ever be in your life.
No doubt.
Just wait until you send them away to college. It's good now.
It's very unbusy.
She's adulting in a different city.
Yeah, Mindy's like looking at me like, I don't know what you're talking
about. Oh, no. Trust me. Those years were, you know, it's sorry to tell you, it's going to get a little harder. So anyway. But listen, before we get into the episode, you know, we take this opportunity on the podcast to really get to know our guests. And I had so much fun reading about your background. And you come from a family of theater teachers and directors. And tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, I grew up around the stage. I was a little theater brat. My mom and dad met doing theater. It's kind of scandalously, my dad taught my mom. And they met doing a Tennessee Williams play. It's one of my boys named Tennessee. And
I love that name.
Yeah. Thanks. And, you know, I grew up around the wings, you know, and around theater in general. And so I never actually kind of thought I would reach TV and film. That always kind of felt like a lottery win. And so I only kind of focused on theater because that's all I knew. But I have a real love and respect for it, and something that I really sought, especially in the first part of my career. I love live performance. There's something about it still that you just can't compete with those moments. You know?
So theater in general, you knew every bit of it. It wasn't just a destiny. You weren't just destined to be an actor. You were drawn to all different crafts of the theater.
No doubt. In fact, I didn't think I was going to be an actor in the theater. I thought I was going to be a lighting designer.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In you know, it was only, I mean, you have to do a lot of electives. In fact, I was just watching Fiddler on the Roof with my mom.
Oh my God, that's so cute.
And the first job in theater I ever had was doing Quick Changes side stage of Tevye and Fiddler. And of course, I don't remember much of it. But, you know, things like costume changes and holding spot ops, I suddenly was getting different perspectives and angles on the stage and what it means. And, you know, it wasn't until I was at University of Tennessee that I was watching Three Tall Women, Edward Albee's Three Tall Women. And, you know, it's really about three women all in different stages of one woman's life. And their father is on the bed. He's the Edward Albee, you know, figure. And the actor only had to lie there. You only have to lie there. But even lying there, he was indicated that he was asleep. And for some reason, it was irking me in a way that was drawing me to, like, I can do that. You know what I mean? At the very least, I can lie on stage better than this guy.
Right. Indication is the lowest form of acting.
No doubt. And if I can see that all the way up at the spot, I can, you know, I just decided that I would take my junior off and take it serious. And I went to National Theater Institute. My mom really afforded me opportunities in the theater, guided me towards Williamstown, towards National Theater Institute. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot, you know, a lot of my success started with just my mom's guidance.
And she teaches at Brown still?
She does, and she's actually retired now. She retired about 7 years ago, I'd say.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but she was the big woman on campus there. Yeah. Everybody was funneled through Professor Marshall's class, whether you were business. She turned businessmen and lawyers into actors. And, right. She's taught an incredible amount of incredible actors and actresses out there.
It must have been so cool to grow up around that and having someone like that sort of mentor you. And
yeah. We also, you know, I have a twin brother. We put her through hell, too.
Because you have a twin brother?
I do. Yeah.
Like identical? Well, I guess you have to be, right? If it's the same sex.
Well, no. We're fraternal, actually.
Just kidding.
But we look a lot alike.
Okay.
We really rebelled against the theater at first. I'm not going to sit here and say we were in drama club, but we weren't. We were in sports. In fact, I remember, I think it was, I don't know if it was me or my brother kicking Diana Ross in the head during, accidentally, as we were fighting behind her during, you know, my mom taught her kids. And that was one of my mom's most angry moments.
But you could use that later on in your acting.
Oh, yeah. I pulled from that moment all the time when I need shame. Accidentally kicked Diana Ross in the head.
Embarrassed my mom. Yeah. So was TV and film, you said it wasn't necessarily, I mean, obviously it wasn't always part of the plan, but how did that happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, I went to NYU. I was, again, very fortunate. I kind of went after the top programs, and I got really, really, I'll just say lucky, because there's so many people, you know, who try out for these programs. And I was really fortunate to go to NYU during a time at its height. And so, you know, I was, and I, at Williamstown, I had gotten representation at the same time, but I told them I'm finishing school. But there was definitely a couple of jobs that were starting to pull me out. And before I'd even, you know, finished school, I had already had, you know, again, I was very fortunate to have reps, because I didn't have to, you know, they're the showcases, you're really trying to kind of dance for your food and find those men and women who can represent you. And so I came out with a little bit of a leg up, and I had actually turned down a big job. In fact, you know, to this day, I wonder if it was a wise move or not. But, you know, there was a very massive movie.
What was it?
Yeah, I guess I can.
I know. I'm like, are you going to say it?
I mean, it was Terminator 3.
Oh, wow. That makes sense.
And, you know, Jonathan Mostow, the director, was incredible. And he, you know, it really pursued me.
But academia is big in your family, and it was important to you.
Absolutely. The MFA. And I knew what I wanted to do was act on stage. And I knew that was going to separate me, you know, on that resume from others, because the theater scene is very small, and it's tough. There are some amazing actors I knew I was going to be up against. And there was a whole crew of actors that I already looked up to. You know, it's this like off-Broadway crew, like Sam Rockwell, Peter Dinklage, mm-hmm. Billy Crudup, John Ellison Conley, this, you know, this like rebel crew of actors. And so I also had this crew of like 17 students that I'd just been in boot camp with for 3 years, and I didn't want to abandon that. Ensemble was paramount for me, so wow. I stuck it out.
In fact, I mean, you were still doing theater right before the OC and like right after, right? You like jumped yes. right back into it, right?
Yes, I mean,
like, get me out of here. I got to go back to winning.
Well, kind of. I mean, I was actually, you know, funny enough, I had just done a play. Yes, a Neil LaBue play. It was my first production. In fact, I think I was being, if I remember correctly, during this episode, I had gotten broken up with by an actress that I had a showmance with.
showmance.
Yeah. And, but I was actually doing 24 at the same time.
Oh, that's right. Oh, so that was wow. your first.
Yes.
Was that your first role on Toach?
No, my first role was an SUV. SVU. No doubt they moved me around in an SUV.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, throughout, I only did about 8 episodes on BOC, and I did about 8 episodes on 24. And so I remember finishing down in Manhattan Beach and being picked up by another Fox SUV and being driven to DeSoto, where they would torture me, where Jack Bauer would torture me.
Oh, wow.
And then turn around sometimes and come right back, wow. you know, on a turnaround and have no, but it was so fun. And, but it was exhausting. And I definitely quickly ran back to, because that's where I was based, is New York,
right.
and continued to get on the stage.
So what ultimately brought you to LA? Or just Hollywood in general? Was it 24?
No, it's bed bugs.
Bed bugs.
Yeah. Bugs? I had bed
literal
bugs.
Bed bugs.
Literal bed bugs.
You were like, what project is that?
Yeah. I was like, uh-huh. Yeah. I did. See, I
was like, I'm with you. I'm like, wait.
Oh, it's a project. No, I had gotten them once, and then I got them twice, and I said, I'm not going to do this anymore. It was mentally exhausting, not just physically, but I don't know if anyone in New York has ever had bed bugs. I'm sure there are many, because it's like the island of the damned.
Yeah.
And I lived in the East Village, was the heart of the damned, and I just was done with, I don't know, I had been there for about 12 years, and I'd gotten a job as well at the same time. I was seeing somebody lived out here, and I just decided to come out, and I started a family soon after that. I'm so glad I did. I love New York. It's my favorite place in the world, but I can't imagine raising kids. Yeah.
Kids, I know.
I know many do, but not me. I'm not made out of them.
Yeah, I always wonder that myself. I'm just like, just the amount of shit you have to like pack into a taxi with kids.
Downstairs,
holding the stroller, and
you know, like allowing your kids to take off on the subway at 12.
Although Ben, yeah. I don't know, does Ben live in the city?
Absolutely,
with his kids?
He's been doing it for many years.
So you are still good friends with Ben, of course. You guys, and you met on the show. Did you know him before the OC?
I knew him before the OC.
You did,
In fact, he was one of the reasons I kind of was like, you know, I want to jump in and play this guy's brother. We weren't like great friends, like best friends. We didn't become best friends, but became very close afterwards. But in fact, we were in a play together, and he was a tree. I believe he had to walk on stilts.
Really?
Oh my God, what I would give.
Yeah, we were in this free play of Williamstown called Bluebird, very fantastical play. But I knew him well enough to know, like, that would be a great dynamic to play brothers.
We had Patrick Rush on, and he talked about casting you. And when they knew they were going to recast or have Trey come in, they wanted somebody that, you know, was correct for this role and this very impactful role. And he had his eye on you, and he said he thought very, very lucky to get you.
Mm-hmm.
So did they offer, or did they have you read?
No, I read. I remember reading with Ben.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Oh. I came into Manhattan, read with Ben. It felt right, though.
Yeah.
And, you know, funny enough, I would actually meet Bradley Stryker, who originated the role.
Oh.
He came onto a show I was shooting, and I didn't put it together. I think he put it together for me. But he's a great guy. I mean, I was also like, why'd you guys let this guy go? He's terrific.
It was like that awkward, like,
No, he brought it to my attention. And it was a head scratch, because he's super, he's a great actor.
Yeah, but you guys, I mean, you and Ben, like the chemistry, everything, it was just watching you on screen. I sound like such a fangirl. Well, like watching you on screen is just like, you're so captivating, you know, and like how you put the, it's like the subtleties in your expressions. And obviously when we get to the famous, the infamous scene in this episode, just like your face is just, it's so interesting to watch. And like I said before we were recording, like I haven't watched these episodes. So seeing you, I'm like, well, Jesus Christ, you know, like it's just so clear that you were the perfect person to play this role.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. And just age-wise, yeah, there was something that, you know, you are just maybe, what, 1 or 2 years older than Ben in real life. And just this, there was, it's such an interesting dynamic between the brothers. And we were noticing in this, throughout your storyline, you did 9 episodes, by the way. But but that he, you know, he was, we were, Josh and company and the writers, they were mirroring in so many ways what happened to Ryan, you know, how he got out of jail, how juvie, and the discovery of the Coens, and but how it's a slightly different thing. And that Trey had this opportunity to kind of go into what Ryan was experiencing, but ultimately we know that he wasn't able to kind of grasp onto that. And maybe he was just, he got too much of his dad's stuff, I guess. But it was just a real, it just made this show so much richer and textured and so dimensional with your character.
Yeah, I always felt that about, and Ben, I think, and I have that relationship. I mean, I'm older than Ben, but there's kind of a, I defer a lot of my status to Ben. He's a super smart guy. And, you know, he and I even were producing something together, but I would definitely say he's the adult in the room when it came to, you know, understanding how to produce something. I'm more the dreamer, I'd say, in many ways. And not that he doesn't have all those qualities too, but I definitely, there's a deferment of status, you know, with Trey to his brother and to this world that he finds himself in. But yet there's this ego, that lizard brain. It looked like I was bringing some lizard brain to it. So.
But, you know, I did want to, you were talking about producing, but you also write and direct. Mm-hmm. And your first feature was Adopt a Highway in 2019 with Ethan Hawke. And are you doing more?
I am. I don't have anything in the pipe at the moment. I'm kind of taking my time and writing a lot. I've got a lot of projects that I'm kind of honing. You know, that project came out of becoming a dad. So I definitely was told, what else do you have? That's always the next thing. Mm-hmm. When they find something good, what else do you have?
Right.
I was told to really slow down and take my time. But that came out of being a father, being lost as a father. I, you know, became kind of a father overnight in many ways. And, you know, I just want the writing to always feel authentic and come from a real honest place. And so I've been really, I'm not in a hurry, because also I love acting, and but I definitely will have some more projects for you guys to watch in the future.
Yeah,
for sure.
So look forward to that, for sure.
Yeah, thanks.
Do you have any memories of like being on the OC, or your first days there, or what it was like, or who was like what?
I definitely felt, you know, I was watching this episode, and I definitely felt like Trey. I won't lie. Like, I kind of used the energies that were around me. I felt like I had walked into something much bigger than myself, that had a whole life of its own and relationships that I didn't have a part in. I felt like an outsider in many ways, and that all felt right. So I just kind of leaned into that. That's the energy that I remember. Now, when I was watching the episode, I didn't remember any of the scenes.
Really?
I do remember Ian, the director,
who
I remember loving.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yes. Everyone loves Ian.
Well, didn't he do 24 as well? Maybe he wasn't on it at the time.
I don't think he directed me in it, but he may very well have bounced back. I just remember smoking cigarettes out front with him, and talking about the role. And I remember bumming cigarettes off of a poor, you know, a base camp PA, and just one day Sean. He turned to me and he just said, can you just buy a pack of cigarettes? But Ian would bum them off me, so but I just remember really loving him. as a director feeling like I was safe to be unsafe in his on his set.
Right. Mm-hmm. And being a guest star always feels like an outsider, you know, and you're feeling, especially in a show that was at that point was so huge. And were you aware of that show before you came on at all? Or was it kind of, it wasn't in your radar?
I don't think I was aware of how big it was.
We're only kind of discovering that doing this podcast.
Yeah, I think I definitely discovered its, you know, zeitgeist, if you will, mm-hmm. when the SNL skit came out.
Oh, you know?
That's really?
I was like, wait a minute, this has got to be something bigger than I gave it credit, because why would it get this kind of attention?
Right, right.
Yeah, we were going to talk about that.
We'll get into
we'll
that.
Save that.
Get, well, you know, okay.
Well, we actually have a couple, so we've got some things planned.
So we asked people to like call in with questions for our guests, and you had the most call-ins and voicemails
that we've ever had.
So we have like quite a few, but we thought we'd break it up. So we were going to play two.
Yeah. We're going to get a couple questions
if
before.
I would love that.
Yeah.
Hello, this is Ashley calling from New York City. Longtime OC obsessed fan since day one. I think I've seen every episode now 100 times over. Mindy and Rachel, thank you first off for doing this podcast. It is amazing. Reliving episode by episode with you two and having these amazing guests speak on it has just been incredible. And just shows after all these years, the show is still just as amazing as it was way back when. So thank you. My question is for Logan. You know, I think you were arguably one of the most controversial characters in the series up until this point. You had a unique way of having the audience root for you and sometimes, and then other times angry and hateful towards you with your decision making. And that was a balance that I'm sure you had to make as an actor. How did you prepare for this role? How did you feel being this really, you know, monumental figure in the show and really setting the scene for the rest of the series with just, you know, these few moments, especially the moment when Marissa shoots you? How did you, you know, prepare for all of that? And just the final comment, I think everyone that's a fan of this show can agree that your face when Marissa shoots you will forever be burned into our memory as part of this show. That was by far one of the most chilling and just insane moments in TV that I've ever experienced. So thank you guys.
Wow.
Thank you. That's an incredible, there's some incredible words and great questions. I can't say I really prepped for the role as much as tried to stay, like we were just speaking about, try to stay in the energy, which, you know, kind of naturally came into something much bigger than myself, in a world where people had their own relationships already made. And just, I you know, when you walk on that set, it really is this built. There's a pool built. You guys know, I don't need to tell you, but certainly those who haven't ever stepped foot on that set, it was a phenomenal set to walk into that soundstage. One of my first ever soundstages, certainly the biggest set I had ever been on. And amongst someone who I was familiar with in Ben, but then there was no one I was familiar with. And I just kind of used that. So I just tried to stay authentic to the fact that I was already deferring status to this process. And I think that worked for Trey. And, you know, I don't really like to view, maybe this sounds cliche, but I don't really like to view my roles as bad guy or good guy. I think everyone's misunderstood in the end. And if you can lean obviously a percentage of good or bad into it, but for me, I like misunderstood guys. And I like falling on my face as an actor or as a character, but I love finding ways to pick those men up. Or those man-child ducks. That's what Trey really was a man-child. And showing you the flaws, you know, and like showing you my wrists. And so that's kind of how I envisioned Trey. And you know, the final scene was certainly found in the moment with Ian, the director, and myself. You know, I think as written, she shoots him and Trey falls dead. But I just felt like it needed closure on that relationship that had gone so awry, given these bad choices he made. And, so it felt like there needed to be somewhat of a goodbye to Marissa. It was just not as just as much of a brotherly fight as it was putting some closure. So I remember asking if I could just turn around and just take her in, and Ian loved it. And yeah, that's kind of what happened. I remember there was a shot though that they wanted, you know, this blood. I remember, and I understood that as an image, a gesture, theatrical gesture. And so that was the only thing I think that was really written, was that Imogen Heap would play and this blood would saturate. I remember
in slow motion.
I remember the thermal being a very important wardrobe piece for that. You know, and those, again, I was learning on the fly there. I was understanding why wardrobe is so important, why these gestures are so important. And I couldn't understand it. And of course, the music, a part of it, until later.
Right. That's, I mean, you never play an actor, at least for myself, you never play a villain as a villain. Villains don't think that they're bad. You know, we're not arch. Although Jess fits the mold.
Yeah, she's,
she's just the arch villain.
But I do want to comment, and I know we can get into this more, and I know whatever, but watching all of these back, when you're saying like misunderstood, I actually find myself, I mean, not siding with Trey in a lot of the stuff, but watching how Marissa interacts with you and seeing how it can be misconstrued, and like, I'm not saying, you know, you should have attacked her, but like just understanding more the misunderstanding in this person. And we kind of argue as we're watching, and we're like, well, what is she doing? You know, and we bring that up a lot. I'm not, it sounds like I'm condoning what happens, and I'm not, but it's just that this misunderstood character, and you know that in Trey, there is something, you know, good. There is good, I think, in everybody. And it's just interesting watching it back and kind of like going through it all and just seeing how it unfolds.
No doubt. I mean, there's the choice to do drugs.
Right.
You know, and whether he lacked a dad to tell him not to do that, whether he was covering up his own insecurities of being in this world that he felt, you know, inadequate in, he chose to do drugs. He also had a Jess, you know,
who, by the way, is like, oh, you could never get Marissa, and like totally instigating and, you know, egging you on and stuff. Yeah.
But the things that human beings create in our minds are our reality, even though it may not be the actual reality. So it could, you know, there's things, if you, and none of us will ever know what goes on inside the mind of somebody who acts the way Trey did.
Right. Or like,
like, once again, this isn't justification. These are things that millions of people do on a daily basis. And it's interesting, or it's important for us to discuss those things. Well, but
we don't get to see the means. We, you know, especially in a court of public opinion, we get to see the ends.
Right.
That's really all we care about. And for good reason, you know what I mean? The choice is a choice.
We're all trying to eat better. But a healthy breakfast doesn't have to be boring. Magic Spoon has the amazing flavors you love, but without all the bad stuff. And it's amazing as a midnight snack right before bed.
My favorite flavor, actually, my husband and I, is the cinnamon. And then I add some toasted pecans and some almond milk. And I did that this morning. I usually do it on podcast days. I don't know. It's kind of a ritual, but I love it. Magic Spoon has 0 grams of sugar. And unless you go with the honey nut, and that has 1 gram of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. It's keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, and it's only 140 calories a serving.
Magic Spoon also gives you the option to build your own box. The 9 available flavors to build your very own custom bundle are cocoa, fruity, frosted, peanut butter, cookies and cream, maple waffle, blueberry muffin, cinnamon roll, and honey nut. And even more exciting, Magic Spoon just brought back their cereal bars. They were so popular that they brought them back permanently. It's the perfectly convenient on-the-go companion for your cereal. I love that there's no sugar in this stuff, okay? My daughter always wants a treat cereal, but now I give her Magic Spoon. She gets so excited by the flavors. She loves it. She thinks she's eating one of the, you know, more treat cereals on the market. Well, she is, but it's just the right kind of treat.
Go to magicspoon.com/theoc to grab a custom bundle of cereal. And be sure to use our promo code, theoc, at checkout to save $5 off your order.
And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked.
Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/theoc and use the code THEOC to save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode.
A change of season means longer days, better outdoor activities, and more ways to get healthier, including checking in on your health and wellness. With Everly Well, you can take action today by taking one of their at-home lab tests or by adding their vitamins and supplements into your daily routine.
With over 30 at-home lab tests, you'll be able to choose the test that makes the most sense for you to get the answers you need, like the Women's Health Test or Food Sensitivity Test. Here's how it works. Everly Well ships products straight to you with everything needed in one package. Take your at-home lab test. Simply collect your sample and use the included prepaid shipping label to mail your test back to a certified lab, and you will receive your results back in days. Listen, hormones can be out of balance at any age, and especially at my age. So I took the Women's Health Test, and it helped me understand some thyroid help. I shared this info with my doctor, and Rachel, I'm balanced now.
I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah.
It's important to be balanced in life. And you know what? Everly Well, it just make it so easy.
Make it.
It made it so easy for me to actually test my food sensitivities because I want to see what I'm reacting to because sometimes I do not feel good. And it was so easy to send in and get the results. And now I'm eating a much healthier for my body life.
Good.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Sure. I get it. And for listeners of the show, Everly Well is offering a special discount of 20% off an at-home lab test at everlywell.com/OC.
That's everlywell.com/OC for 20% off your next at-home lab test.
everlywell.com/OC.
Hi, ladies. My name is Caitlin. I live in Boston. I love the podcast. I listen to it every Tuesday on the way to work. And I'm a huge fan of the OC. I started watching the show when it came out and I still watch the reruns. And Logan, I just want to say that Trey was probably one of my favorite TV characters of all time. I think he just brought so many layers to him and he felt such empathy for the poor guy. He had such a tough life and he just couldn't help himself in so many ways. And my question for you is, do you feel that what happened with Marissa on the beach was a little bit over the top, even for the OC? I just felt like Trey was a lot of things, but he never would have hurt Marissa to that extent. And it would have been great if that hadn't happened because maybe you would have been on the show longer and you were such an amazing character. Take care. Bye.
Yeah, I think that's it ties right into what we're saying. I think a lot leads, you know, we don't just make, I mean, I don't know if you're a soft determinist, hard determinist, or believe in free will, but for me, I'm a little bit of a soft determinist. I think that a lot of environmental, hereditary, and just simply the accumulation of choices leads us to the macro choice in the moment. And like we're saying, he had his girlfriend egging him on, he had drugs, he had a lack of a dad. And then he had Marissa, who he was mistakenly or not taking signals as a green light for him. But, you know, having, if I'm going to be really frank, I'm sober now, but I used to drink and I used to have a drinking problem probably as a 20-year-old, as I hope a lot of 20-year-olds do in many ways, because just I had a lot of fun in my 20s. But I can definitely tell you that you make choices that you would normally not make if you were sober. Mm-hmm. And I think it's safe to say that Trey through a lot of these episodes was not sober.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So let's just talk about that. And, you know, do I condone that choice in the end? No. But you know, there are certainly bricks in the foundation that have to be looked at. And I think that the OC and Josh and the writers did a great job of showing those choices that led up to that horrible night on the beach where he wore out his welcome.
Right. It's a cautionary tale. And I think that's what these shows can certainly portray, the devastation and the trauma and the pain of all of these characters and the aftermath. I mean, it can be educational, but it's also not pretty, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily to, you know, and the responsibility of creators who are trying to portray things, something that's very prevalent in our society. And unfortunately, you're exactly right that, you know, I have a daughter in college and I'm constantly, you know, hearing these stories about, you know, their kids are doing things that they're supposed to. And instead of me wagging my finger at her, I say, take notes.
Sure.
Take yeah. notes.
Absolutely. I mean,
you feel like shit today. You don't want to go to work. Take notes.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
What, I mean, what am I going to do? Say, you know, you have to be on your journey and you have to figure these things out.
Yeah. I was raised by kind of 20th century great generation parents. My dad flew in World War II, my mom. Yeah. Oh, wow. And so it was absolutely not,
right.
You know, it was, I will eliminate this reality mm-hmm. from in front of you. And I think that's all the more reason why I chose to drive you towards
went, yeah,
it.
Yeah, for sure.
But that's not a mistake on my mom's part. That's how she was raised too.
Right.
It's all yeah. cumulative.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I had the opposite experience, but my mom
go out
like, yeah. Oh, you smoking pot? Oh, you lost your virginity? Oh, cool. Let's talk about it. Mom, I don't talk about my vagina with you. So that was my experience.
No. Let's stop. What's your name?
Yeah. Listen, anyone.
Her mom's a sex therapist.
She's not like officially a sex therapist. Oh, she's but not. She counsels, and let me tell you.
Well, you seem to be doing okay, right?
That's what you ask, but you know, watching that scene is hard though. Like,
you guys did such a great job.
You did such a good job.
Thanks.
Like, asking her to howl with you, I'm like, that might be the hardest thing as an actor to do convincingly. Like, for me, just like those moments that are so.
Well, they're also at, you know, 4 a.m.
Right. You know, right. And you're not, feeling
it's,
it.
It's, they're never romantic at night. It's, you know, you're on the beach.
Yeah.
And it's cold.
And, you know, if I remember that scene and, that was one of those moments where I knew I had to be in DeSoto shooting 24 at 8, you know, I had a call time at like 8 a.m.
Oh, no.
So that I remember that scene. I was kind of working the other scene in 24 in my mind, too. And I was not equipped to handle, to juggle. So, luckily there, you know, when you're shooting a night shoot, there's a lot of deliriousness.
I found that people always ask if you prepare, but it's like, if the writing's good, that's all the work I have to do in that character. And especially if you have the opportunity to do multiple episodes over multiple months, you know the character, and then that you become very proficient in the character itself, and then trying to find new things and developing that character. But using outside exhaustion is a very good tool.
No doubt. And, you know, it was it's an awkward, you know, look, any intimate scene is awkward. I don't think there's an actor here who, if they take their job seriously, would say that it feels romantic. It never feels romantic. It's a grip eating lunch next to you. You know, it's cameramen right here. You have to fight through so much to find that ounce of intimacy. And especially if it's an intimate scene where one character is taking advantage of the other.
Do you remember working with Misha on that? And because you both were so brave in the...
I do. I remember we were both exhausted.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remember it was loud. And I remember we knew we were going to have to ADR the whole thing because of the waves and, you know...
Especially a scene like that. You're just like, no.
Yeah.
Because a scene like that, the performance is so in the moment and how frustrating it is to ADR.
So ADR is when you have to re-record it in a studio or whatever. So it's not an actual scene. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people know that, but just in case.
Yeah. There's a lot of elements you're fighting against, especially when it comes to TV, they're honing that 42 minutes. And so there's only so much you can do. There's so much left on the floor in the sand, so to speak. But, you know, I certainly remember running up and down the beach because I had to be out of breath at one point, you know, to make up, I think the post when she runs off and, you know, you're sitting there just cold and it's not going to work. So I had to run up and down and just try to stay in it because I also knew I wasn't going to bed. I was going to be tortured by Jack Bauer, in a few hours.
That's amazing. So there's no such thing as 12-hour turnarounds when you're doing that.
Well, no, when you're working two projects, they get their, they get their option on you. And they take claim. But it was both Fox shows, so they just took full advantage of this little actor.
Do you find yourself being a method actor, so to speak?
No, absolutely not. I recall like method actors, certainly. I use recall for emotion. But I just act. That's how I was trained. I've never really understood the method actor, if I'm being honest. Yeah. And obviously, proof is in the pudding. There's lots of great method actors out there. But I'm much more of a Laurence Olivier than I am a Dustin Hoffman. Mm.
Mm. I found that, yeah, that can be sometimes similar.
I mean, I can't. Yeah. Method, to me, I'm just like, I can't not. Sorry, I mean, it works for people, but it's not something I can, in my brain.
Well, it abandons you eventually of certain roles. I just don't know how you would maintain it. But again, I guess I'm a lesser actor. There are certain, you know, roles. How do you method? How do you recall a serial killer? Or
yeah, that's a little like, how can you tap into this?
Kidnap. Where do you go for your process at that point? I just feel like at some point it would abandon me.
Yeah.
Being a lesser
actor. That makes sense. No, but yeah. It makes sense to like have to go there.
Do you still get recognized for Trey? Because for like Ben and Misha and Rachel, they get, you know, and Adam, they forever, forever are referenced in every interview. It comes up. Did that happen to you for a while, or has that left?
I mean, I think it's still there. I think there's always going to be, you know, there's always the, you'll always be Trey to me. But, you know, more and more, I think, I've moved away. It's been almost 20 years.
Right.
So I think it's just out of just time, anything else. But certainly I think in many of my fans' eyes, they came into my career when they saw me as Trey. So yeah. And I love that entrance because I really love that character. I really have a lot of like empathy for Trey. Mm-hmm.
Were there any scenes that you said don't remember, like shooting them and whatnot, but any that stand out to you as either like the most fun or the most challenging, or, well, I guess what we just talked about sounded pretty challenging. But like a funny one where you broke, or do you break? You seem like you don't break too much.
I mean, I'm not I'm focused and intense guy. I take my work a little too, I probably took it way too seriously back then. I've learned to kind of let go a little bit more. I do remember the Rager. Mm-hmm.
It was for your birthday.
It was my birthday.
Yeah.
Was it my birthday?
It was your birthday.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yes.
And it turns into this big Rager.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And floater
Jess
girl.
Is the floater girl.
And it was your house, right?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, look, this is a bit of a non sequitur now and digression, but I do remember that being Bosworth's house.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
I Bosworth. Say
yeah.
That.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. Bosworth. No, absolutely.
I'm a huge college football guy. I remember being completely starstruck by the location.
And the house is massive up on that hill.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yeah, massive house.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think they even had us, you know, kind of our holding areas in certain rooms, and mm-hmm. you could see his, I mean, I just was so starstruck by the location. You know, and I hadn't been to many locations at that point.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I really don't remember shooting. Which I should absolutely remember. Like when I was watching this last episode, there's this huge shootout and debate shot.
Oh, yeah.
I can't rack my head around how we shot that, when we shot that.
The same, but I guess one of the things is that I actually watched the show and then I would make people watch it after drinking wine. And I was like, hey, let's throw it in, you know? And then, but I think sometimes my memory is that I actually watched the show. Not necessarily that I remember. So it's. Should we say the synopsis really quick?
Of the show? The episode, I mean?
Of the episode?
Sure. Go for it.
Kirsten hits rock bottom after Caleb's funeral, prompting Sandy to stage an intervention. Jimmy Cooper, Tate, returns to Newport to renew ties with a mourning Julie. Jess convinces Trey into participating in a dual drug deal.
In a duel.
Same thing. That turns into a shootout at the bait shop nightclub. And Ryan learns the truth about what happened between Trey and Marissa, leading to an epic confrontation directed by our lovely Ian Toynton, written by the Josh Schwartz. Josh Schwartz. Josh. And that original air date is May 19, 2005.
Oh, Lord.
Is he here?
Yes. we have a special guest, some of you may have heard of.
What's up, Josh?
How are you, man?
I'm doing great. It's great to see your face and your voice.
Excellent. How are they treating you in the podcast?
In the pool house.
So far, the seat is not too hot yet.
Sorry, good. Did Rachel remember that you had been on the show?
She looked at me like, I think I remember. No, she did. She's recalled everything beautifully.
She remembered that she was on the show, so that's good.
Barely.
Well, I'm like Rachel. When I watched that episode, this episode we're going to talk about, it was the first time I'd seen any of the episodes. So I'm at least on an even playing field with her.
Perfect.
One of my kind.
Yeah. So we haven't even talked about this epic episode. And I honestly, I think it's one of my favorite of the entire series. Actually, this whole second season, I think, has been my favorite as a viewer so far. The fourth one was fun to do, but the second season really was.
Notice how she just skipped right over three.
Well, we haven't gotten there yet, but we only have you for a little bit of time, right?
Yeah, I thought I was coming on to talk a little Imogen Heap, but I'm here for whatever you would like to.
We've been talking about the episode, and we have gently brought up that scene. Well, we've talked about it a bit, so we would love to hear anything you'd like to share with everybody about it.
Well, I feel like that was like the last scene we shot of this season, but if my memory is correct, I could be wrong, but I feel like we ended there. We've been building to that finale all season long, obviously. And I feel like the original pitch may have come from Bob D, if I'm correct. It was this, the shooting. And we staged, a pre-dramatic fight scene. You guys got really into it. If memory serves, there's a glass table that gets shattered. I mean, it's kind of like we felt like we had to go for it in a way that we hadn't in any of the other prior kind of physical encounters that Ryan had gotten into. Obviously, this was something extremely primal between two brothers. And then Marissa having no choice but to intervene and pull the trigger and what that meant. And, Alex Pinsavis had, as we've talked about, would send music every week, to listen to, and just kind of that could be right for the show. And I remember her sending the CD, because that's the era it was in, with that Imogen Heap song on it. And it was around the time, I believe, we were heading to Miami. Or maybe it was earlier in the season. But anyway, I heard that song. It was immediately like, don't know where that song is going, but it's going on the show. Like, it's just too haunting. It's too, I never heard anything like it. It just felt like it had to go on the show. Rachel, you look so bored right now.
I'm not. I have a hair in my eye. Why are you, you keep talking. Don't mind me. I literally have a hair in my eye. I can't see.
You're literally like removing fake eyelashes while I'm trying to.
Hold on. Let me just take my extensions out.
Anyway, knew the song was going in the show somewhere, and it felt perfect for the funeral and for Caleb's funeral. And then Norman Buckley, our editor, was the one who was like, check this out, and had brought the song back to reprise over the shooting. And it was just this moment where we're like, yeah, this is really going to work. This feels like super dramatic. It ties the whole episode together. It coming in on the middle of the song like that just felt really unique and powerful. And, 8 years later, it was still being parodied on Saturday Night Live. So,
was it eight years later they did that skit?
It was randomly like 8 years later or something much later in the run of. And to me, that shows that we did our job. If 8 years later they could do an SNL parody and everybody knows what you're talking about, then the scene was memorable.
I found a quote from Imogen, and she said that it was really important. She said that before you guys had used it, that a DJ had told her, this will never play on the radio. Nobody will ever like it. And because of the OC, it connected. And she was so grateful for that.
That's awesome. We had requested that she not license it to anyone else. We asked for it exclusively. Because you didn't want to have been on some other show the week before. So she did. She waited it out. And, it's definitely not a song at that time that would have been an obvious radio song. Mm-hmm. And then it got worked into a remix. There was some big song several years later, a couple years that we ended up using on Gossip Girl, actually, where the chorus was part of the song. So the song has kind of lived on in multiple versions.
She also said that the Dear Sister, they did not ask permission, and she got nothing from it. They just did it.
It has like 37 million views on YouTube, we heard.
The SNL skit?
Yeah.
Well, I'll take that up with those guys. He paid handsomely.
I have a couple questions for you real quick, though. There was, you know, when this episode came out, there was a lot of speculation about like what was going to happen. And there's a line where Seth says, the doorbell rings and he says, the way things are going, I bet that's Oliver. There was a huge speculation from the fans that you were going to bring back Oliver. Did you put that line in there because of that? Or was it that coincidence?
Yeah, we were just too online at that moment. So we were definitely responding to, what was out there. I also want to say, by the way, that Logan, you crushed this whole thing. It was so good. Yeah. It was bringing a whole other level of intensity to the part. And that's what really elevated it. And I feel like you and Ben had this great dynamic and you kind of brought out the best in each other. And that reaction that you have when she first shoots you, that look back to her, is just so good. It's so good. Man. You can't script that. And I feel like that's a huge part of why people still remember that scene.
Well, we were just saying that when you have good writing and a good director in like Ian, it really just follow the pillars of the verse as it is, you know, and let it kind of guide you. And I remember it being a very, we knew exactly what the gesture, you know, the cinema was going to be in a way. And Ben, of course, mm-hmm. and I think felt really safe to be unsafe with each other, you know, so we went for it.
Well, it looked like you guys did a lot of the stunt fighting yourselves.
Pretty sure we did almost all of it, except I don't think they allowed the crash. You know, Ben's a little too important for the glass table, but, you know, yes.
There was something in the choreography that was so real, so dangerous and scary. And there was something also that came out in that scene that was so important because now it's not just about Marissa. He goes back to you, I didn't want to steal that car. It goes back to so much. And then something in Trey comes out that he actually is going to fucking kill his brother. There's this anger and it's almost that he knows that he's surviving. Is he defending because he knows that his brother will kill him? Mm. Do you remember or thinking about that at all? Or?
I do remember, you know, talking about, you know, what it's like to fight with your family versus like a friend. And I think, you know, switches get flicked a lot easier when you're with blood, you know, and blood is thicker than water, of course. And I think that's why I actually have the same dynamic with my brother. Josh, I was letting them know I have a twin. I don't know if you know this or not.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And you know, and my brother and I were Cain and Abel growing up. We did not get along. And when we fought, you know, one of us fought to the death and the other one had to understand that dynamic and kind of pull away. And that's just what it was. And I'm sure is in many other sibling rivalries or my brother and I get along great now. But, you know, we definitely had our fist fights and stuff through the years. And, you know, one is willing to go a little further than the other always. How far, I think, it's depending
like when
on
you
person.
Reach for like the phone, like
not with
shit.
My actual brother, but with yeah,
right. Oh, sorry, yes, no, yeah. Yeah. But you just can't, you're like, oh, he's about to smash his head in,
yeah,
bye bye. Yeah.
But it was so
primal,
it was, yeah, and it was. And it was so shocking. And I think there's something about watching it now that I don't remember it having as much. It was just so impactful. And it was sad and tragic. And this, like you said, the look on and like you said, it was closure for Marissa and Trey because of this, you know, terrible thing that had happened between them.
Good first shot by Marissa, by the way. First time pulling the trigger.
Right.
I thought the same thing. I was like, how did she know how to, like, she was just like.
Well, it feels a little lucky. She's kind of shaky if I'm watching.
Right.
Yeah. But I can see it absolutely hitting its mark.
Do you feel like a whole generation of kids are going to not know that it came, that song came from this SNL skit or all these other memes like Game of Thrones? We just watched one on Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
It's
I don't know. I mean, I certainly didn't know what the song was. I still, sometimes the song will come on. It's so it's so interesting, the beginning of it. And it's only until it gets into it, I realized like somebody's played it because I'm in a bar or something like that. I'm like, oh, I'm stuck in the Imogen Heap song now. And I bet somebody actually karaoke it because I was.
Oh, really? Yes,
that's a really hard karaoke.
I was just going to say.
Absolutely, it is.
Hearing that would be
It's a very avant-garde and progressive song. It's when I saw the skit and understood the scene, I was like, wow. I mean, you guys are already known for the music, but this was, I thought, a great, strong choice.
I definitely think it was our most, the most impactful musical choice we made on the show, for sure.
I think when people think of the OC, they think of this.
Famous song from the OC.
In California, for sure.
Oh, right, that. The theme song.
That's what we played it 92 times for people or whatever it was. But I do remember also after the episode aired, getting calls from like executives and what have you, whose daughters were screaming and called them like hysterical crying, and they thought something terrible had happened to like one of them or their loved ones. And they're just like, Marissa Chatre. Like it was just like really had, it worked. That's all I could say. It worked. It was a good, it's kind of cliffhanger you aim for.
Yeah, well, I watched
it. Like Marissa, we hit our target.
Right. But I was just surprised. I'm like, Trey dies? I'm not allowed to say.
Well, do you not know?
I don't.
But you don't know?
No, I only know because I said this before and Mindy told me what happens. But I didn't know. I didn't even know Caleb died, by the way. When we first started this,
I was there. Like, you were at the funeral.
Well, you know, I don't know.
So what, speaking of the funeral.
A terrible thing to waste. Yes.
I love that Sandy uses the eulogy to roast Caleb, which was, you know, being. You know.
Yeah, what else are you going to say?
Yeah.
That terrible.
This guy sucked. Good riddance.
That was humor.
But since I have you here, or we have you here, that the intervention scene was just incredible. And, Kelly Rowan did an incredible job. And it said so much. But I thought about the season finale of the first season, where she was so dramatic when Ryan leaves. Was it a coincidence that you gave her as powerful of a scene in her emotion for the second season? Or did you have that in mind that you wanted to give her that?
I mean, we certainly knew that she was capable of it, you know? So we knew, given the performance at the end of season one, that whatever we wrote for her, she'd be able to deliver. And she did. Yeah. And Logan, forgive me, I'm fuzzy on the details here. But you had come out of, you were doing theater, right, in Massachusetts.
That's right.
At
Williamstown Theater Festival.
Right. And Ben had worked at Williamstown. You guys had crossed paths at Williamstown a little bit, peripherally.
Yeah, Ben, I believe my second or third summer there. I did about five. But Ben it was his first summer. He was one of the apprentices. But he was definitely one of the hotshot actors there. And he and I did a play together, this fantastical play I was telling the ladies, called Bluebird. And all I remember is, and I've still kind of always called him out on it to this day, is he played one of the trees that he has to come out on stilts. And I mean, if you could find the photos, he would be, I'm sure, happy about it.
Won't come on the podcast, so I can only imagine what the photo would do for him.
Well, you know, you never know.
Have you talked to him about coming on our podcast?
Oh. I have.
Yeah, hey, Logan, have you?
I don't think I'm your messenger, but I know Ben. He's somebody who will surprise. You never know.
You guys already kind of had a big brother, little brother dynamic in a way, I guess, going into it.
Yeah.
I remember that we kind of leaned into.
No doubt. I thought it's a great dynamic, considering, because we didn't have so much familiarity, you know, where we were like besties, but there was definitely a, an older brother, younger brother, but yet he was kind of king of the castle when I walked in, and I loved that. I think we used that, if to answer your question, Rachel, if I remember, and I don't remember a lot of the scenes we shot, but working with Ben was always a highlight there, because it was just a familiarity and we worked really well together. We kind of came from the same school in many ways at Williamstown, and really valued process, you know, on stage and respect each other's process. So
I remember he felt the same way about you and definitely brought his A game.
Do you think there's this idea that when Trey shows up in the beginning of the season that, you know, Ryan's like, yeah, he's very cautious about letting Trey in, but everyone around him is like, give your brother a chance. And his spidey sense, his intuition is it's never gone well. And by the end here, he just is resolved to say, see, I told you, and this has to end. That he spent all season trying, and it just didn't work the way it worked for him.
Right.
Because he was never following the path that Trey was following. He was following, trying to do his best, right? And he came, and they just have two different journeys, and it didn't work.
Yeah, and I think sometimes if you come from your broken family, or you have, there's abuse in the family, and one sibling is older than the other, it impacts the siblings differently, And I think definitely Trey got more, it landed on him in a way that kind of shaped him. And sometimes you're like, I got treated this way, therefore I'm going to treat other people this way. And and just the difference of being born a couple of years later, you decide I'm going to make a different choice and I'm not going to repeat that, So the way that abuse trickles down can kind of manifest in different ways, in different personalities.
I think there's also a little bit of an element of luck, that comes with, or mm-hmm. at least in our cinema, that, mm-hmm. these two boys, one just had maybe a little bit more luck, than the other. And one might make it to the gas station on empty, whereas the other guy, he runs down and doesn't make it, and has to steal a car.
Ryan had Sandy as his lawyer, and Trey did not.
Yeah. But being again, advocates, right. Who's advocating for you?
And that's what Marissa is, the first one who somewhat advocates for him, and he responds to that in a big way.
And mistakes probably that advocacy as coming on to him or flirting with him, and yet all she really I think wanted was what. Ben maybe couldn't figure out how to want, which is like, I want the same for you as I wanted for, Ryan.
And then you created this character of Jess, which we called very arch and like the classic villain, person that was almost worse than Trey, just to somehow pull him away from the good and into the dark. That was very, she's wild.
Reframe him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now she works in casting. Yeah.
Right. I know you have to go, but did you always know that Marissa was going to shoot Trey?
Do we always know?
Yeah.
From the day I was born. No, I think we figured it out. It was part of the conversations of bringing Trey back on. And, it's similar in the same, the end of season one was about Ryan's past coming and that undertow pulling him back out. And that was the shape of the end of season two as well. So it felt like once Trey came back and it was going to go bad, it was only going to go one way. And there was a lot of conversations I remember with Bob and Stephanie about how the season was going to end. And it just, you said Cain and Abel, and it did have that kind of biblical kind of archetype.
Romulus and Remus. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Marissa definitely gets the intense storylines.
No doubt.
What if Summer just ran
don't
in?
Tell Rachel, like, don't tell Rachel what happens at the end of season three. Because,
I want to know. You should have put the Imogen Heap song there too. Just like every time there's a death.
You don't remember, but she actually does perform Hallelujah over the closing scene of season three. But so we brought her back to, so it fused the end of season one and the end of season two musically.
I remember, but he carries her and she's,
Do you remember the end of the
oh, we shouldn't say that.
In season four?
No.
Do you remember what
definitely
happened?
Definitely not.
Okay. But I will say, I remember when Seth and Summer run into the scene at the end, and we debated that because you guys always kind of lived in a slightly different version of the show, and so having you guys enter into that storyline was always a bit jarring because it was just, you guys were sort of the Beatrice and Benedict kind of like comedic element. Mm-hmm. It was always a dramatic piece to it, but it never fully crossed into the kind of the Ryan stuff. And so having you guys land in that was
literally tricky. Into the crossfires. Just sent us on in.
Well done, Rachel.
Thank you. On that note, you're welcome. You may leave.
Logan, it was so good to see you.
It's great to see you too, Josh.
Congrats on everything, man. Take care.
Likewise.
Thanks bye-bye. So much
bye,
for
girl.
Stopping
bye,
by.
Bye. Bye,
Josh.
Bitches.
Bye, bitches.
We've touched on the intervention and Kirsten's need for sobriety. You're looking at me like I know you have like a lot you want to say.
Mindy mouth here. Yeah. The things that were very impactful for me were obviously, the first thing that's going on is that Seth finds this rehab document or, this pamphlet, and he brings it to Ryan. And does he think for a second it has to be, it's for Sandy? But I think one of the things that I would like to discuss was just how interesting the journey was for Seth when he realizes that this is what's going on with his mom, and this, and the scene with Sandy and Seth, that was probably one of my favorite scenes in the entire series.
Which scene?
When he's saying, hey, just so you know, this is what's going on. And because Seth says mom hasn't been very mom-esque, and this dynamic between father and son, you know, and Peter and Adam just doing so well. And his realization that, well, come on, her dad just died. She's having a few drinks. What do you mean you want to shove her, to send her away? What, maybe you're the one that caused this. And that this kind of classic thing of he's number one in denial. Number one, you haven't, there's number two, you haven't told me. And this realization when he talks to Summer about the fact that, you know, maybe I'm partly to blame. I left last summer, and Summer says, I think it's bigger than you. You are being self-involved. And when he's just, those scenes were just so well done with that he's in complete denial.
Can I just want to say one thing I loved about that scene in the kitchen, you know, where Seth and Sandy are fighting about it, was the end of the scene, that they didn't go to coverage on Seth. It was just him throwing that final zinger of a line over his shoulder. It was so, it just felt so, that is the dynamic, the teenager just leaving the room with one, you know, it just, there's something about that we didn't get to even see him say that line. He just throws it over his shoulder and it landed even, I just felt it landed even better.
Mom's anyway. A drunk. She's going to rehab. Plan your afternoon accordingly. And that's Norman Buckley editing that. It's mm-hmm. just this, I'm angry. And he doesn't know how to process. And then when Sandy comes back upstairs and discusses it more and he's calmed down a little bit and he's like, this isn't us. This isn't supposed to be us. His only reference to this kind of thing is that it's Ryan's life. But mm-hmm. somehow this idyllic world has just been shattered. Mm-hmm. And you can't help but think, like, yeah, what's this all about? And I can't send my mom away. And I mean, I don't even, obviously, as adults, we could say, oh, you're being selfish, Seth. This is what she needs. Nobody knows what anybody needs in these situations. It's just like, you know, right?
Yeah. I agree.
What was it in that scene? Was it the master that they played it?
Yeah, it was the master, and you don't see his face. He just very kind of petulantly. It's a very petulant. Just, you know, can I swear on this?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And just all it's a fuck time. You, you know. And it's to, you know, Ryan who walks in and there, but there was just like a handoff of the scene. But normally you would think, especially on the network, you would go to that coverage of that line. Mm-hmm. So it lands, but I actually think it landed even better, Ian or the editor, whoever decided.
Right. Yeah. And then when she actually does, you know, Haley shows up and she takes her out for a spa day and the actual intervention, I was curious. I mean, we didn't have a chance to ask Josh, the show intervention, it debuted on March 6th of that year. And this came out a few months later.
Was that like a reality show?
Yeah, it was like where they actually did it interventions mm-hmm. because okay. And I was like, okay, even though it was kind of a short condensed thing, mm-hmm. it's very reminiscent of that. And it's Kirsten comes in and she's like, hello. She's all sweet. Nice to meet you. Okay. What's this all about? And they instantly start declaring, you know, that they're scared for her and what they feel. And she's like, everyone's overreacting. And Haley, you're the one that was doing drugs. She instantly just throws it back and she's defensive. And when Ryan goes to speak and she goes, don't say a word. I brought mm-hmm. you into this house. But what he says is, yeah, because.
But I like how he doesn't look at her at first. Like Ben's eyes are just like inverted, like down. And then once he finally addresses her, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's like, because my mom couldn't take care of me and I don't want that. And you would think that is such a great argument. And Kirsten looks and she goes, and I am not going. But she turns and sees Seth. And I wonder what it is that she just melts. And everything she said, you see all
it's her kid. I mean, as we know, like your kid is like your Achilles heel, right? Like anything. I mean,
you gotta go. But you see the pain, the shame, the embarrassment, letting go. And because she has been trying to handle all of this. And
it's a very human moment. I mean, those are our most human moments when you realize your kids are just as much a human as you are, and you're just as flawed as them, and that they're going to raise you eventually.
Right.
You know, 100%. I don't know exactly their history, but certainly that's got to be a pillar in their relationship between them in the show, that he kind of is the parent.
Well, I think it's actually really significant because we haven't seen Kirsten and Seth. He's on his self. He's on a self-involved journey right now. He's been saying it quite a bit.
Permanently on a self-involved journey.
and he's navigating. And this, his mom lets him be him. We have not seen a moment like that because she has done that last season. She did that with Ryan. But now it's Seth that kind of melts her heart. This is just one of the most heartbreaking, because the show is known for comedy, and we don't really have that much of it, thank goodness, in this episode. But it was done so well.
Can you imagine and with if, care. Like, Seth runs in with a joke afterwards and shoots you.
Right? No, I just don't. I don't remember.
The SNL skit just starts playing.
I don't think there would have been one.
That's true. Fair.
Yeah, I just don't remember it being as impactful. But I know that it was impactful when it aired. But now it's like, I don't know what you felt watching it, but it was just heartbreaking.
Which one now?
Just the whole thing.
Okay.
Just in general. Just the whole thing.
What are we talking about?
I do remember thinking when I watched it the other night, like, wow, we're going there everywhere. Every scene. Like, this is a final. This is number 24 in the season.
Yeah. So. It was very intense.
Yeah. It was
to intense. Say the least. But then, and the other thing I'll just touch on briefly, but I don't know what happens. Like, Jimmy comes back, you guys are going to be together. But I know Tate's not on the show, so I'm like, well, what happens?
Okay. Right. Well, it was actually, TBD. So when the doorbell does ring, and after Julie asks for something to wear for Marissa, and Marissa's being kind of nice to her, but I recognize that silhouette anywhere of Tate at the door. Mm. You just know.
Mindy gets really like flustered when we talk about her and Tate.
Really?
Her and Jimmy and their little like sexy.
Well, you know, Tate and I, just as a quick side note,
if
there's anyone I've kept up with, it's Tate.
Really?
Because Tate and I have been in a volleyball game.
What?
That has been, what? I'm not kidding. Has been going on for over a decade now.
Are you serious?
It's a very loosely gathered.
I think I've heard about this. And Ben shows up too sometimes.
Ben's been there too.
Yeah.
Same team or?
It depends. We're on any team that just feels even. But
volleyball, like beach volleyball?
Beach volleyball. There's a group of about, I don't know, 15 of us on a thread. And every single one of us is our, you know, one of us is the leader and begins the thread on Thursday and starts to see who wants in. And
like every weekend you go?
I mean, I'd say we have taken certainly breaks, especially with pandemics.
Yeah,
and, but we just had our 10-year anniversary. And we all got together and went to.
Was he in here big, in LA?
Oh yeah, He's whenever he's here, we play.
Wait.
So I think we're playing on Sunday.
Tate, we will be there. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I'm mad he didn't call me.
Well, he is also like myself. A lot of people come and go. It's kind of a ragtag.
Yeah, he's in always Texas about, now. Yeah.
You know, eight of or at least. Four, all you need is four to play beach volleyball.
Oh,
so, we've kept that ball in the air, pun intended.
That's awesome. Tate, Kelly, and now this one, but I hadn't seen her for 10 years.
Oh, me.
But Tate, Kelly, and Peter, we stayed in contact. Mm. Tate, I'll just pick up the phone and call from time to time just because he's
I'm telling
fun.
You when I say.
Were you and Tate very close? What was your relationship like? I mean, you guys obviously had an intimate relationship.
He's my favorite person. He's literally my favorite.
He's one of mine too.
It's just
he's so awesome.
Just so funny. I mean, even when we were on set, he would tell stories and he would just do it with just so much humor and joy. Like that dude practices joy.
No doubt.
Like, attitude of gratitude. It's not just an attitude. It's you got to practice that joy. And we have so much fun. And that's what we would just giggle the whole time. So I was so devastated when he was leaving. So him coming back was just,
With powdered sugar donuts from 7-Eleven, no less. I didn't know if they're, are they good? Do you know?
You saw that I took one little bite.
You're like, I'm not eating this.
Aren't they called donuts?
Donuts?
At 7-Eleven?
Yeah, I think they're those little packages. Are they the packages?
Oh, the Hostess one?
The Hostess. I think they're called donuts, if I'm remembering correctly.
But, it is kind of
really
interesting.
Really gone off the rails here.
That they instantly, they reconnect. Julie says, I feel guilty about this and let's try it again. But you you know, is Jimmy a bad guy? I don't know. But he definitely has questionable, I think, reasons for being there. And we'll find out. But it is very sweet when Marissa says that we want to try and be a family again. And she actually hugs Julie, I think, for the first time in the entire series, which was very, very sweet. I think this is the time when Julie actually stops being an antagonist and becomes a protagonist and for the show.
I look forward to seeing what happens.
There's something really important that Summer does throughout this when she notices
how Marissa's awkward around Trey.
Yeah, she notices that, and then it's the scene.
Do you know what? Sorry, that just reminded me. Who says the line like to the dudes that come for the drugs, and they're like, "Oh, your rice rocket." I was like, "Oh my god,
get in your rice rocket and go."
How did you get away with that?
I couldn't believe it.
I couldn't believe it. Yeah. I was like, "Oh shit!"
We were the Wild West, I think, back then.
Yeah, back then for sure. There's been so many of those times where we're watching things and we're like, "There's no way."
But that is that is a comment on maybe White Orange County, classic Newport biatch, as he calls her, and then she calls him a derogatory name.
No, I felt it was coming on me too, because I certainly, it didn't register to me on the day, and then I was like, how was I in a scene allowing that line to exist?
Right.
And it was just a different time, and I was naive.
Right.
You know, I think we all were naive at some point in our lives.
Yeah, for sure. 100%.
But yes, Summer does notice, and then she confronts the beauty of that scene where she confronts Marissa and says, "Look, I'm your best friend. Let's go sunbathing and get some pancakes, but not until you tell me what's going on." And we don't need to hear it.
Yeah.
But Marissa just cries. Mm. She just cries. She's still having a PTSD, and now crying out of the pain, out of the trauma, but she's also crying that she gets to share it with somebody, and thank God somebody noticed, because she's trying to cover and protect everyone, but not let this secret out.
But that's what I wondered, because Summer like instantly tells Seth, who instantly tells Ryan. I don't know. It was something that maybe Summer felt like she had to share, because I'm sure Marissa wasn't like, go, you know,
I think,
be the town crier. You know what I mean?
Yeah. My thought was, why didn't they go to Sandy? But Sandy's got a lot going on. He's at rehab. He's dropping Kirsten off at rehab. And Seth doesn't learn that lesson until season 4, that he needs to go to Sandy for these very, very big things.
I was just thinking of the scene where you and Ben are switching with Marissa when she's having PTSD. Do you remember this scene? No. It wasn't this episode. So
it's this episode before.
And Marissa is like trying to put it behind her and shows up to the pool house to make out with Ben. And it's intercut between both of you.
Oh, wow.
So it was so well done. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really well done.
Oh, wow. She's like picturing
you. She's having flashbacks.
Yeah. I'm in her mind.
You are.
But there is a lot of release in that moment. And I think, like, especially with teenagers, you know, you're trying to find those moments where you can adult put on the, and I think sometimes we just, you know, there's always a gossip, you know, element to teenagers. So,
For sure.
I think that's enough about the episode.
Hi, Rachel and Melinda. My name is Sophia. I'm from Denmark, and I'm a huge fan of the OC and this podcast. And how exciting that Logan Marshall Green is on. So I was watching Normal People, the TV show, and suddenly the song Hide and Seek came on. And I got so emotional, both because the scene in Normal People was good, but also because I was immediately brought back to the scene where Marissa, she shoots Trey. But I was wondering, is there a song for you that incidentally reminds you of the OC? It can both be from set or your personal life, or just a song from the show. Thank you so much, and bye.
Thank you.
Do you have a song that reminds you of the OC besides this one?
I mean, you know, I definitely can say the song reminds me now of the show, but not of the process of shooting that scene. You know, we spoke about it a little bit before, but it, you know, when you're shooting the scene, you don't have, rarely do you have the music playing. Now, sometimes the director will show you what he or she intends to put under it, but certainly on TV, you don't, you don't know. And we didn't in the moment. But it just goes to show how important music is, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, I have directed something, and you know, there's the saying, there's the movie that you write, the movie that you shoot, and the movie that you cut. But now, having directed, I do believe there's a fourth film, which is the final film, which is the movie that you score. It changes everything. It can, you know, and certainly with the movie I directed, not to stay on that, but the composer was a great singer-songwriter who came on, Jason Isbell, and he really showed me the film in many ways, how he scored it, and he had an original song there, and I kind of understood it in a way. It's just like, I think with this song, Hide and Seek, I understood really what the intent was, the gestures were. And it really, the scoring and the music always is the final piece. And without it, or with a different song, it's just going to be a completely different scene. Iconic, I'm sure, still, but I don't know if it would ever be as iconic if Josh had not known that he, you know, really, as we just heard, he held a placeholder for it. And it kind of, like, I think probably spoke to him, this is it, or to the editor, whoever made that final decision. But I think it's so interesting how music guides us, not just through our lives, but through our narratives that we watch. Because take any movie, any TV show, or any play, and if you put different score to it, your emotional attachment to it is going to be different.
Right.
And certainly it was a perfect song, I think, in the end.
It just goes to show that what we do as actors is just a very small part. We do what we do, mm-hmm. and then they put, between editing and music and sound, it puts our performance together. We only do what we do. And then there's a whole team of people that put it together into what the audience ends up seeing.
Yeah, you have to, I think you have to be an orphan. You have to orphan your choices as an actor. I think it's the best way, because I agree, you know, you get to be on the center, you get to be on the mark, and everybody's focused on, you get, you know, and there's becomes a lot of ego that gets thrown into that, but you get humbled really quickly as an actor, I think, in realizing your place in the final product, because we are just a department, and we're not, you know, the department. Mm-hmm. We are a department. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really your job as an actor is to show up on time, yep. know your lines, and hit your mark.
Yep.
Now, those who do it really well understand, I think, all of the other departments, mm-hmm. the elements, and so that they are acting as a whole,
right.
you know, not in a selfish way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love that you're saying that. Like, it's the difference between, like, being, like, good, hopefully, but also professional, you know?
No doubt.
Yeah.
Yep.
Being a technical actor is a very, very important attribute.
I agree. Absolutely. Yeah. One of my favorite people in the world is Dylan McDermott. Mm. And, you know, one thing Dylan has always maintained is if you look at Dylan, he's as sharp as anyone can be in focus, because he knew standing on that mark correctly, just the technical aspect of making the eyes as sharp as possible allows for so much more. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do whatever you want, but if you're constantly in and out buzzing, you're not going to get those choices on screen. So whenever you look at Dylan, a lot of the times he's kind of coming up from just looking at his mark.
Yeah.
But nailing everything he does.
It's important to know lenses as well, and knowing where you are. I mean, and knowing what's required for different mediums, whether you're on stage or on film. I always try to give that advice to young people, like, know your light, know your lenses, know how far, know what's going on, and do it. It can only make you better and also just more proficient. And
I always like request the bright pink tape. So like, I don't have to look, and yeah. So I can totally be in a scene, but like out of my peripheral, I can hit my mark.
That's so smart. I never even thought about that. Yeah. You know, those dark greens and blues, kind of find. And that's you know, a cerebral that you don't need to be super quality. You don't need in your right. process. So it's actually really,
I think I'm
going to start.
You're like, I
am
pink.
Definitely going neon, no matter what the color is.
Well, you know, if you're on a series for a long time, they tend to give you the same color all the time. Yeah. I think I was pink on
you
the
OC. You were soft pink. No, you were purple. You were purple.
I was purple. You were pink. Because if somebody comes on and changes it, it fucks with your head.
It messes you up. No, yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, you were purple.
That's right. I was purple.
You were. And they gave, they got me.
Special
baby bike. Pink, like special. But my other series, I'm always hot.
Do you guys remember everybody's color on Instant?
Is that weird that I remember? Well, because I love purple. So I remember, I was like, oh, Mindy got purple. But then it worked in my favor. I have a weird visual, like photographic memory. It's the only memory I have. It's photographic.
Right.
I feel like, no, I don't know. I should do that now. I think Misha was orange. Is that right?
I thought she was red.
This is really interesting.
Anyway, one more question.
Hi, everybody. Hi, Rachel. Hi, Melinda. Hi, Logan. It's Thabo here from South Africa. I grew up obsessed with the OC and I'm absolutely loving the podcast. Ladies, please keep up the brilliant work. My question for Logan, you know, on season 4, we kind of saw everybody's happy ending. You know, Julie goes to school, the Coens have a baby, Ryan gets a job, but we never find out what happens with Trey. The last time we see Trey, he's in prison and nearly gets his brother in trouble, if I'm not mistaken. Now, my question for you, Logan, as somebody who portrayed Trey, what do you imagine his ending being like on the OC? Is it a good one? You know, does he eventually clean up his act? Or does he go in and out of prison? Does he eventually reconcile with Ryan? I'm very curious about that. Yeah, I guess that's my question.
Well, I'm obsessed with South Africa, so thanks for your question. I love South Africa. That's a great question.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've been asked it once before.
Really?
Not into that depth, not to that specificity, but certainly like what happened to Trey, mm-hmm. You know? You know, the melodramatic actor in me would say that there's, and maybe there's a good picture for Josh, that you follow, it's not a comedy, but I definitely think it's a tragedy, unfortunately, for someone like Trey. And I could see him owing a bookie in Vegas some money, and, you know, having to work that off or find even worse choices that pile up. And I don't know if Trey has a long life, a shelf life, unfortunately, on this earth. It doesn't feel like he had the right cards dealt to him. And I don't think he knows how to play the cards, unfortunately. So I could see him, you know, I could see him probably being killed, you know, for owing money to somebody in Vegas, you know, once he's in a bigger pond, you know, high school is one thing, the OC is another, but I think Vegas, which is where, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, where he ends up, I believe, at least last we see.
Die.
Well, I'm telling you, he does. now I'm telling you, now I'm telling Josh also, he should write that show, but, no, I don't think we ever know, yeah. I guess. And but it's a great question. I don't know if he has a long shelf life.
I feel like he's, you know, he kept saying to Ryan when Ryan would confront him, he was like, what do you want me to say? I screwed up. Like, he says that time and time and time again. I know I screwed up. But if he's accepted the fact that he's cursed, this is just who I am. I'm cursed. So I think people tend to. Whatever they put out into the world is what comes back to them. And no, if he's putting that kind of energy out, then he becomes a tragedy.
Well, you know, there's something if you listen to that final fight, and something in all of his bad boy moments, there's a little bit of joy. Like, he loves that pool fight, you know, I remember in the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
With Chris Backus. That's one thing I remember, is Chris Backus was in that pool in the first episode, I think, who also I would become friends with. He's a great guy. But there's just that little bit of love of getting entangled in bad choices. And if you listen, there's even some laughter. Like, he just loves that we're going there. He and his brother are going there.
Gets off on like the adrenaline.
It's very stimulating. Yeah.
I think it's a idiosyncratic. I didn't want to twist a mustache on it, but you know, it's just something. I think that he can't help it. Mm-hmm. He just kind of loves the bad choices,
yeah.
and just sits in and marinates in it. You know?
But you said something earlier, which I think is really true about just luck. You know, like Ryan was lucky and Trey was unlucky. I do think in life there is an element of that in people and situations. I mean, you know, the older you get, you're like, oh, well, I'm really unlucky. Or, oh, fuck, like, you know.
But then you could also argue that he was lucky enough to have Ryan, and then he's actually presented with this world of, look at all these people, we're here for you, we're here to support you, you got a job, but then you have this character of Jess that just pulls him into this dark side, or he can't help himself anymore.
Yeah, I think it's all the above, you know.
Yeah,
it's your hereditary, your genes, your environment, and it's got to be a little bit of luck. I think, you know, I am somewhat of a determinist, but luck, I think, would throw that out the window. And I definitely believe in luck. I bet I'm an actor, and, yeah. I've been very lucky to only have to be an actor, and I know what luck is in this business. Yeah. And a lot of luck is, as that saying on the wrestling wall, is preparation and timing. You know,
preparation meets opportunity.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's what luck is.
That's what it says on wrestling walls.
It's what you say on our wrestling wall.
Okay.
Is luck. There's no such luck. Is preparation plus timing.
Yeah.
That's what right. This and luck is.
I like that. You are very prepared.
How's your timing?
I'm trying to let go of the control. Well, Logan, this has been such a treat and a pleasure to see you again, and to just hang out in the pool house and talk about something that we all collectively went through together many years ago. And just, you know, thank you so much. And I know the fans really appreciate you coming on, and it's been rad, man.
No, thank you. Right back at you. It's been therapeutic, cathartic, and
right.
and eye-opening. It's been nice to have a reason to go back and revisit a show I hadn't really seen. So,
yeah. Right. Well, you should watch your whole performance, because it's really, I mean, I don't know. Maybe you're not like one that like, I made it to watch myself.
You know, we could end with watching Dear Sister.
You know what? That's what I want to see.
I kind of want to see it.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I love every single person involved in it.
Yeah.
And as an artist,
yes.
You know, and
a very talented group of.
I was definitely more honored than. You know, but it certainly it gave me some insecurities. I don't know if I was just too young.
It's the highest form of flattery.
No doubt.
I did not understand it.
She's still asking. She's like, I don't get this.
I don't get the skin.
Oh, I got it. And that's what made it so hurt so much and be so fun.
Hey, man, what you doing?
Nothing. Just writing a letter to my sister.
Cool.
It's pretty crazy. I haven't seen her in years. It's a. It's weird because that you only meant well, of course you did what you say.
And we just found out that was a Logan choice.
Oh, the look, yeah.
The look.
If nothing else, you would be a part of the inspiration for that.
I mean, what an all-star group, too.
For sure. Oh, my God, it kills me.
I'm honored.
Wow. On that note.
The thing is I'm going to walk around the rest of the day just being like,
See, I like that remix a lot, too.
Right.
I know Josh said there was another one.
Yeah.
That one kind of kicked ass as well.
Yeah.
I'm still thinking about how you do that in karaoke. Are you literally up there like, but
again, I don't.
And then you're like,
at the beginning of the song is what it always escapes me, because it just doesn't sound like the rest of the song.
Oh, right. It starts out. It's like, where we.
Yeah. But I think it was big enough. Karaoke will grab anything that's big enough.
Yeah.
So.
Wow, everyone.
This has been an adventure.
Thank you so much for listening. Please follow, rate, and review Welcome to the OC Bitches wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you like to watch us, and I think you should on this one, you better check it out on YouTube. Bye, bitches.
Bye, y'all.
When Shopify says you can sell anywhere, they mean it. Ooh, hold up. Just got a new sale. Whoa, Shopify doesn't mind if you're at sea level. Or on top of the world!
Whether you're selling carabiners or crop tops, start selling with Shopify today and join the platform simplifying commerce for millions of businesses worldwide. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up for a free trial at shopify.com/podcast22. Shopify.com/podcast22.
Hi, everyone. It's Rabia Chaudhry.
And I'm Ellen Marsh.
And we have a new podcast called Rabia and Ellen Solve the Case. As you know, I am a very smart lawyer.
You are. You're so well-respected in the entire world. You know everything.
Thank you so much.
And as you know, I am a famous Broadway star. Gorgeous. I sing like a nightingale.
Well, yes. At least that's what your mom says. Just kidding. This is Ellen Marsh
and I'm Rabia
Chaudhry. But we are teaming up to bring you a show like you have never heard before.
True crime meets talk show. Nobody's done it. We're going to do it. We're going to do the impossible. And it's the two things that I love. Ellen, I think you like it too.
What? True crime and talking?
Yeah.
I'm there. Every other week, we will have a guest talking about whatever true crime case they are obsessed with. We have a list, everything from the Lacey Peterson murder.
Yeah, some of the most famous cases you've ever heard of, obviously, like JonBenet Ramsey, the West Memphis Three.
Chris Watts, Khalif Browder.
Elisa Lam, Madeleine McCain.
Sandra Bland, the Springfield Three. The list goes on and on. But they are all cases that you know, and we are going to dive in deep with someone else and just talk about them.
No. We're going to solve the case, Ellen.
That's right. We're going to solve the case. So subscribe to Rabia and Ellen Solve the Case wherever you get your podcasts.